Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Trump's campaign rally on Saturday, where, instead of attending the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner, he fired up his base with attacks on the press in a dangerously divisive speech that essentially cast the majority of Americans who did not vote for him as the enemy. Timothy McCarthy, a lecturer on history, literature, and public policy at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School and author of Protest Nation, Words That Inspired a Century of American Radicalism, joins us to discuss the GOP's drift from conservatism to nationalism under Trump and how he has segregated his alienated followers into an alternative universe in which his voters believe their leaders' lies while dismissing the mainstream media as fake news. Meanwhile, Trump courts the same mainstream media that he trashes, seeking their approval, if not their praise. Then we'll speak with Jody Freeman, the founding director of Harvard Law School's Environmental Law and Policy Program and the co-author of Global Climate Change and U.S. Law. She served as counselor for energy and climate change in the Obama White House, and we will discuss yesterday's marches to raise awareness of climate change and Trump's remarks yesterday about beautiful clean coal and his not-so-veiled threat to pull out of the Paris Accords. Then finally, with the latest GDP numbers showing this quarter's anemic economic growth of 0.7%, we will speak with Bernie Sanders' economic advisor, Stephanie Kelton, who served as chief economist on the U.S. Senate Budget Committee. She joins us to discuss Trump's one-page plan to make the American economy great again and her article in the Real World Economics Review, Can Trumponomics Extend the Recovery? And joining us now is Timothy McCarthy, who's a lecturer on history, literature, and public policy and director of the Sexuality, Gender, and Human Rights Program at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. An award-winning scholar, teacher, and public servant, he is the author of The Radical Reader, a documentary history of the American radical tradition, Protest Nation, Words That Inspired a Century of American Radicalism, and The Indispensable Zin, The Essential Writings of the People's Historian. Welcome to Background Briefing, Timothy McCarthy.
Thanks, Ian.
Yesterday in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Donald Trump made this extraordinary campaign speech. He obviously avoided the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner to talk to his people. And frankly, he does have a real connection with his base, it's clear. But it's also scary. It's frightening. If you watch the whole thing, the impression I had was that people who didn't vote for him are the enemy. And David Gergen, who served about five presidents, most of whom were Republicans, has said that he's the most divisive and dangerously divisive president we've ever had. How did it strike you?
Well, I agree with my colleague David Gergen that the speech was incredibly divisive, although this is not anything new from Donald Trump. I mean, his rise to political prominence and his election to the presidency was forged through a series of divisive actions and a whole panoply of divisive rhetoric. This is someone who is not at all interested in uniting America. He's absolutely committed to dividing America, and he's done that. That's probably the greatest success so far of his presidency.
Well, the division, though, that I find extraordinary is in how he has segregated his supporters into an alternative universe where they believe him, think he's honest and trustworthy. There's a recent Washington Post ABC News poll that says something like 89% of his supporters think he's honest and trustworthy, and 78% believe that the mainstream media propagates fake news. And that was very much the theme of yesterday's speech in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. He railed against the failing New York Times and the so-called fake news. So I don't think we've seen anything like this since Joseph Goebbels or Joseph Stalin.
Yeah, a couple things in response to that, Ian. The first thing I would say is that, you know, Donald Trump's political style is to, on the one hand, bully anyone who gets in his way, anyone who offers a criticism, anyone who raises a tough question, anyone who would challenge his political power. That's one part of what he does. The other part of what he does is he seeks to marginalize and alienates those who are most vulnerable or most disagreeable with him. So ordinary people, whole groups of people, Mexicans, Muslims, gays, women, African-Americans, you name it. And that's sort of what he does. He bullies and he marginalizes. And this is that's at the core of his political practice. You know, I don't have a problem, per se, with a sitting president going to the people to engage directly with them in the places where they live. All presidents have done this to some extent. President Obama has done it. Other kinds of presidents have done it. Sometimes they do it with these big rallies. Sometimes they use the media to do it. But President Obama was very effective using social media and the internet. FDR used the radio through his fireside chats. John F. Kennedy and others used television for with Ronald Reagan used cable news. So it's not unprecedented for a president to use various media and various opportunities to talk directly to the people. The concern I have is not with that per se, but with what he says when he talks to the people. And that's what you're getting at, is the increasingly divisive rhetoric that we see from Donald Trump, the aggressive rhetoric, the authoritarian rhetoric of seeking to undermine institutions like the media, like the courts, even the legislatures and Congress. This is a man who is waging a full frontal assault on American institutions, on democratic institutions that serve to not only advocate for or to raise tough questions, but to try to preserve our democracy, and also institutions that try and check and balance the abuses of power that are always waiting in the wings and always lurking, right? We're a democratic culture, but we have authoritarian tendencies. But Donald Trump is the worst of those, I think, in recent political memory.
But what he does, though, while demonizing the press, he also courts the very same people that he demonizes, the New York Times. He is almost like an actor who's more interested in his reviews than his actual performance. He spends hours every day watching, for example, the press conferences that Sean Spicer conducts. And now he doesn't want to fire Spicer because he has high ratings. And that's the world that Trump inhabits, the idea of celebrity and ratings. So given the way that he plays this cynical game of demonizing the press to his base, at the same time courting them and trying to seduce them, why does the press go along with it? Why don't they boycott him?
Well, it's a very interesting thing. You know, Donald Trump manifests, and I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist. I'll leave that to my colleagues at Yale and elsewhere who have deemed him problematic in those ways. But one of the things that I think Donald Trump consistently manifests is a kind of pathological paradox. On the one hand, he is someone who derisively and aggressively goes after what he calls the sort of lamestream media, the mainstream media, the failing New York Times, Washington Post, etc. And yet at the same time, he's a deeply insecure and narcissistic man who wants affirmative attention. He wants people to pay attention to him. He wants people to like him. He wants good ratings. He wants, you know, big, you know, rallies. And he's so insecurely obsessed with this with attention, and so he can't help himself. Simultaneously, while he's attacking the mainstream media, he's also courting them in a weird sort of way. One of the things that I was thinking about the other day, he must have been devastated when Tom Brady and so many of the other Patriots didn't show up at the White House. He must have been devastated when the side-by-side pictures of his inaugural attendance and Obama's inaugural attendance, more people showed up to march for women's lives and march for social justice the day after the election than showed up at his inauguration. And I'm sure that roils him at his core, because he is someone who, as I said, is narcissistically obsessed with affirmation, with being liked and being a celebrity. And so you see this operate over and over and over again, this way that he desperately needs that affirmation that plays itself out in all these ways. And yet at the same time, he attacks the very people who would give it to him. And so there's a certain kind of paradoxical dimension to his pathology, and we saw this in the campaign, we saw this in the lead up in the general election to the election itself, and we've seen it literally every single one of the 100 days since he's been in office, which to many of us feel like 100 years.
And again, I'm speaking with Timothy McCarthy, a lecturer on history, literature and public policy and director of the Sexuality, Gender and Human Rights Program at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's the author of The Radical Reader, a documentary history of the American radical tradition, and Protest Nation, Words That Inspired a Century of American Radicalism, and The Indispensable Zin, The Essential Writings of the People's Historian. Well, there is a kind of Groundhog Day quality to this obsession he has about the crowds at his inauguration.
Yeah.
I mean, he actually, in the interview that he did the other day, with, I think it was the AP, actually, he had these printed maps about his great victory and all of this stuff. I mean, he keeps referring to his extraordinary Electoral College victory, which is certainly, less than average. I know you begged off the psychiatric or amateur psychiatrics, but have we ever had a president with such manifestly perhaps apparent mental instabilities, or at least, I think it's called extreme narcissism or chronic narcissism. I can't remember what the
I think one of the reasons why I'm so resistant to engaging in a kind of armchair psychoanalysis of Donald Trump is, one, I'm not qualified, and two, I think to label him mentally ill is an affront to those who struggle with mental illness and mental health in the country. And the last thing any of us need is to be lumped in with him. But to be more serious for a second, I think that anybody who reaches the point of being a viable candidate for the presidency, or someone who gets elected to the presidency, has a certain amount of narcissism flowing through them. We certainly have seen Bill Clinton had his own deep-seated desires to be liked and affirmed and so forth. There was certain narcissism there, even with, President Reagan and President Obama, President Bush, certainly President Nixon. I think Nixon is probably the closest comparison that we can make to Donald Trump, because we know now, with the distance of history and the careful scholarship that's been done on the era of Richard Nixon, that Nixon was incredibly insecure and unstable, and that he was full of anxiety and heard voices and all of these things. But the difference between even Nixon and Donald Trump, and certainly the other presidents since Nixon, Donald Trump, is while they may have a certain amount of narcissism that sort of fuels their desire to be the leader of the free world, they don't articulate themselves in public in quite the pathetic ways that Donald Trump, and pathological ways in which Donald Trump seems to love to do. That this is a person who is constantly talking about crowds and ratings and numbers and the people who love him. And he speaks in superlatives all the time, almost as a kind of linguistic projection of his own anxious desires to be talked about in those superlative terms. And the thing that I'm sure drives him crazy is the way in which that superlative discussion of Trump has taken on a quite negative turn, that he's the least productive president in the first 100 days in modern American politics, that he's the most divisive president that we've had in certainly in my lifetime, that he, when people talk about him in superlative ways, it's often very negative. And so that must drive him crazy. And so my feeling about that is that we need to keep doing it because, those of us who were always opposed to Trump as a candidate, and also to the Trump presidency and all that it represents, need to keep up the criticism. We need to keep up the dissent. We need to keep asking tough questions. We need to marshal and mobilize and sustain a resistance to the worst devils of our nation, which I think Donald Trump represents. If he's a leader of anything, he's a leader of what is worst about our country. There are a lot of great things about this country, including its radical devotion and practice to free speech and free press and free assembly and petition and so forth. And these are things, in an ironic way, that are fueling dissent right now, that are fueling a kind of democratic, critical questioning of his presidency, of him, and it's fueling the growing mobilizations that are taking place that we see all over the country week in and week out that really represent what is becoming of this movement moment. I mean, just yesterday, as we had the kind of chaos of a White House Correspondence Dinner without a president in attendance. The alternative, the not-so-formal or official White House Correspondence Dinner that Savannah B. broadcast, the rally that Trump had in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. We also had the march, the climate change march yesterday here in Washington, D.C., where hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets to call out climate change denialism that this presidency is trading in. We've seen marches literally, I think, every week since the inauguration itself, since the spectacular and unprecedented Women's March that took place this Saturday after his inauguration. So, you know, I think on the one hand, we can be scared and we can be even terrified with what comes out of his mouth and what we see unfolding in his presidency. But I also think that we need to be incredibly hopeful at this moment, that we have people who have awakened to a kind of resistance that I think is absolutely necessary in this time, and I'm proud to call myself part of it.
Well, I think, you know, I hesitate to give Trump credit, but I do believe he was very effective, more so than I think I've seen anybody. Like, you know, there's the old... Obviously, our politics have changed from a meritocracy where you vote for people who you think are the most competent to you vote for people who you think you'd like to have a beer with. But given George W. Bush and then Obama's performances and how much they engage their base, I've never seen anybody engage their base in a more effective way than the way Trump does, because he offers very simple solutions to complex problems, but he shares with them his presidency, you know, his decision making, you know, why he went on forever yesterday about why he no longer calls China a currency manipulator. I mean, it was ridiculous, frankly, but it was effective. It was very effective, I thought.
Yeah, no, it's no question. I mean, we have to take him seriously. I mean, that's one thing that I want to be very clear about, is I'm not one of those people who seeks to dismiss Donald Trump. He's the most powerful person in the United States, and he may very well be the most powerful or certainly impactful person in the world right now. And so I want to take him very seriously, not his ideas, but his power. And those are things that, and I think we need to make that distinction. I also think, you know, the fact of the matter is that Donald Trump spoke to something in the culture, and I think he spoke to three things. The first thing he spoke to was the widespread economic anxiety and economic paralysis that so many people are experiencing in this moment of incredible and growing economic inequality, and that's the legitimate part of what he's saying. The second thing that I think he's speaking to for some people, which is why so many small business owners and middle managers and people who still believe in the kind of myth of the American dream and the myth of meritocracy, he spoke to a kind of reality that the American dream is still alive and well, that it's still attainable for some people, that we can make America great again, that somehow America has been on the decline and he's going to bring us back to some mythical world of a great America where everybody, you know, worked hard and got ahead. And that, I think, is a little bit more problematic, but it still speaks to that economic anxiety and inequality that people are feeling and experiencing. The thing is, the most troubling piece of this is he articulates all of the fear and loathing and anxiety about others, about people of color, immigrants, undocumented people, women, LGBT people, people who are on the downside and have historically been on the downside of discrimination, but who have, because of a whole series of laws and opportunities, gotten ahead in some cases. And the people who are experiencing this, certainly the white working class, the fabled white working class that was so much a part of his days, are anxious about the fact that these others are somehow taking what they deserve, that this is the real violation of American meritocracy. The real denial of the American dream is that all these outsiders and others are taking what these people think that they are owed. And so that's the problem here. I would like to decouple the very legitimate appeal to an anxiety and inequality based on economics divisions and economic distance, and decouple it from the fear and loathing and anxiety that is rooted in the racism and the sexism and the homophobia and transphobia and xenophobia that is so much a central part of Trump's rhetoric, of his lexicon, of the way that he communicates with the world. That we can have a critique about economic inequality and how economic institutions are not serving everyone, how the American dream has been diminished over time, without being racist and xenophobic and discriminatory and prejudiced in all of these ways. These two things in a way are canceling themselves out. The illegitimacy of that prejudice is undermining our ability to have a legitimate and long overdue conversation about economic inequality in a country that has experienced a greater division, is currently experiencing a greater division between rich and poor, an accelerated increase in concentration of wealth at the top. The 1% has never been richer, and the rest of us have never been poorer, more anxious, more unequal, and more divided. And we have to get past the prejudice in order to get back to a place where we can ask tough questions so that we can move forward to progress.
But Timothy McCarthy, that's exactly what Bernie Sanders is trying to do now. He's trying to get the opposition to rally around income inequality and recognize that the economic issues are what is the glue that should tie the opposition together. But he's running up against identity politics.
Well, let me say a word about Senator Sanders and identity politics. The fact of the matter is that we don't have one type of inequality in America. We have inequalities in America. And one of the things that I think, one of the limitations, as much as I respect Senator Sanders and what he's done and what he continues to do, I think Bernie Sanders' analysis is limited because he plays into this false distinction and false choice between economic inequality or class-based politics and an identity-based politics of race, gender, sexuality, and et cetera. And we need to actually have an inequality politics that is based on an understanding that we experience inequality differently. Transgender people experience inequality differently than cisgender people. Black people and brown people experience inequality differently than white people do. Men experience inequality differently than women do. Gay people, but differently than straight folks. And we have to have a more sophisticated analysis, not the one that pits class against race, gender, and sexuality, but one that understands class through the different experiences of racialized people, of gendered people, of sexualized people. And until we get to that place, a more sophisticated analysis of how identities and inequalities converge and inform one another, then we're always going to be stuck, especially on the left, with this kind of false battle between class and everything else. And I think Bernie Sanders is limited in that way. And I think we need a new generation of politicians and policymakers, of activists and advocates who can bring a more sophisticated analysis of identity and of multiculturalism together with a more sophisticated analysis of the ways in which our economic institutions have failed so many of us.
Well, just in the last minute, I'd like to touch finally on the GOP and the direction it's heading in.
Sure.
A lot of analysts are saying, Timothy McCarthy, that the GOP is morphing from conservatism into nationalism, almost a bitter form of nationalism. What's your thoughts?
Yep. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, one of the things that we're seeing all over the world right now, it's not just in America, we're experiencing our own version of it. We see it in the UK with Brexit. We see it in France with the rise of Marine Le Pen. We see it all over all over Europe and in the West and the global North. We see this rising nationalism that is rooted in a kind of insecurity about nationalism. And that's the thing that's so interesting to me is that this nationalism seems to be speaking in a full throat or with a full throat precisely because it's so anxious, because global capitalism has created these inequalities, because migration, because of wars that have displaced people internally and externally from their home countries, that the migration and the inequality and all these things that we've been talking about have produced an anxious global moment. And the rise of nationalism, the attempt to wall ourselves off, to exclude people from our countries, to see ourselves as operating as a kind of party of one within a more complicated global environment and landscape is a problem. But the nationalism itself is rooted in an unstable foundation of prejudice and anxiety and inequality. And so we have to push through the tendency to close ranks and to close our borders and to close ourselves off to other people to get to a place where we see ourselves as more interconnected. We see ourselves as more able and willing to share our resources so that everyone can live lives of decency and dignity. I mean, if there's one thing that I think most human beings, if not all human beings, share, it's a desire to be free, to live a life of decency and dignity, and to be treated equally by other people and the laws and institutions that hold our societies together.
Well, Timothy McCarthy, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian. I appreciate it.
I do too, very much. Thank you. And I've been speaking with Timothy McCarthy, who's a lecturer on history, literature and public policy and director of the Sexuality, Gender and Human Rights Program at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. He is the author of The Radical Reader, a documentary history of the American radical tradition, and Protest Nation, Words That Inspired a Century of American Radicalism, and The Indispensable Zin, The Essential Writings of the People's Historian. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back discussing yesterday's People Climate Marches to raise awareness of climate change and Trump's remarks about beautiful clean coal and his threat to pull out of the Paris Accords.
Sacred land, and it has seen many hands. It has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old. And now the greedy souls just don't care to know of the changes it will confront. So speak out loud of the things you are proud. And if you love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds. Cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jody Freeman, who is the Archibald Cox Professor at Harvard Law School and the founding director of the Law School's Environmental Law and Policy Program, the co-author of Global Climate Change and U.S. Law. She also served as counsel for energy and climate change in the Obama White House. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jody Freeman.
Great to be with you.
And yesterday, there were a number of, I think about 300-odd marches around the world, billed as People's Climate Marches. There were 200,000 people in Washington, D.C. in the sweltering heat. They marched down Pennsylvania Avenue and surrounded the White House and let out a collective moan as though coming from the very, you know, agony of Gaia herself. What was your sense of this extraordinary contrast between yet another manifestation of spontaneous resistance on the part of American citizens, at the same time a president in the hermetic bubble of his own base talking about beautiful clean coal and threatening to pull out of the Paris Climate Accords?
I think it is a pretty jarring contrast. I think, you know, everything the president says about coal and fossil fuels, it all seems very much about yesterday. He doesn't seem to understand that a clean energy transition is already underway, and it's not mostly because of regulation or government. It's mostly because of the market and mostly because there is a lot of innovation going on in the clean energy space. So I think yesterday people were making their views known that they care about climate change as an issue, and I think more generally they care about environmental protection, and they see what he's doing, you know, to roll back these protections that have put in place now for many generations. So I think they're expressing their wish to have clean air, clean water, and to have a government that's serious about the transition to clean energy.
But just before the People's Climate Marches on Saturday, Donald Trump opened up banned offshore drilling in sensitive areas like the Arctic and off the California and Atlantic coasts. So could there be another explanation here? Given the influence that the Koch brothers have over the Trump administration, in particular, Mike Pence, who's one of their proteges, along with the new head of the EPA, who's also another one of their proteges, and having Rex Tillerson, the former head of Exxon, as a Secretary of State, is it possible that the dirty fuel extractive economy is trying to have its last hurrah, one last gasp of a dying industry?
You know, I don't know about the background dynamics that are going on, and I don't really get into sort of conspiracy theories. But what I can tell you, Ian, is this yesterday's behavior by the president and his ongoing rhetoric, it's all of a piece. You know, it's a lot of signaling and gesturing to a core constituency of his in the coal sector. And he's really making a bunch of empty promises about bringing jobs back. And they're not coming back. And the reason is because the market has moved away from coal. It happens to be, although for many years it was crucial and remains important in our energy economy, it happens to be an incredibly dirty and dangerous fuel. And sometimes the public makes known that it cares about public health. And so we are moving toward cleaner sources of energy. And that's a good thing for society. And it happens to be falling heavily on parts of the country with coal jobs. Those coal jobs have been disappearing for a long time. They're not the product of anything the Obama administration did. And what he really should be doing is announcing plans to help revitalize and diversify the economies in these areas and help people out in transitioning to new kinds of training and new kinds of jobs. We need an education plan. We need a lot of things. But what he's been promising and opening up offshore drilling and reversing the pause on new coal leasing in order to open up more public lands to coal mine, all of this is a bunch of empty rhetoric. Nobody's interested in drilling right now in these offshore areas. The price of oil is too low. There's not going to be a bunch of new leasing in these parts of the outer continental shelf. There's not going to be a bunch of bidding for new coal leases because coal's losing out to cheap natural gas as a source of electricity. So you see a lot of smoke and mirrors at the presidential level in the White House. You see a lot of executive orders and announcements of things. But it just is completely contrary to the dynamics and reality on the ground.
Well, I certainly was struck by the recent announcement that Tesla, Elon Musk's electric car company, has a greater market capitalization than General Motors. So that would support what you're saying. In other words, in the real world, the economic bets are being made on clean energy, not on dirty energy.
I think that's right, and I think that valuation actually surprised even Elon Musk, who commented in the press that it's really quite astonishing. But it shows you what people think the future is about. And the future is about a transition to these sort of cleaner sources of energy. And I think that the Tesla story is a real story of innovation and really future-oriented thinking. You look at one of these vehicles, and they're very impressive. And I think young people out there, when they see this kind of innovation in the transport sector, and they see alternative clean energy sources for electricity, and they see things like solar panels and opportunities to invest in technology that will actually feed power back to the grid, I think generationally we're going to see an embrace of all of this innovation. And I think we're headed toward a much different energy future. And everything the president is doing is really just part of this retrenchment and clinging to an old past. So all the signals, and actually all the businesses understand these signals, all the signals are in the direction of moving out of coal and more toward natural gas, moving out of both coal and gas toward more solar and wind power, and in the transport sector, moving to hybrids and then all electric vehicles over time. I just think this is an unstoppable trajectory. Maybe possible to slow it down for a time with the president's retrograde policies, but I think the writing is on the wall, and sophisticated players in the business community really understand this.
And again, I'm speaking with Jody Freeman, the Archibald Cox Professor at Harvard Law School and the founding director of Harvard Law School's Environmental Law and Policy Program, the co-author of Global Climate Change and U.S. Law. She served as counselor for energy and climate change in the Obama White House. But nevertheless, even though the promises, of course, and in yesterday's speech in Pennsylvania, or rally in Pennsylvania, Donald Trump did talk about beautiful clean coal and how he loves the miners and how they're all going to go back to work, which, of course, flies in the face of a recent study by Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy that concluded that Donald Trump's effort to roll back environmental regulations will not materially improve economic conditions in America's coal communities. He still can do some real damage in terms of pulling out of the Paris Climate Accords, which he talked about in the rally, hinting very, very heavily that it was a one-sided accord where the United States pays billions of dollars while China, Russia, and India and have contributed and will contribute nothing, quoting him. And he said, that it'll be decided in a couple of weeks, but I'm kind of leaning against it. So what do you think's going on there?
Well, you know, once again, unfortunately, everything the president says about the Paris Agreement is just fundamentally misinformed. You know, this agreement is actually the most balanced, most inclusive international agreement on climate change in the history of international negotiations on this subject. And what I mean by that is actually all of the world's major economies are pledged to this agreement. It's not just the developed world. It's certainly not just the United States, but all of the world's developing major economies too. China and India have pledged as well significant reductions in their carbon intensity per unit of GDP over time. So everybody is in this, and it's actually very different than past agreements that bound just the developed economies. And the other thing to say about this idea that the U.S. is going to pay billions and billions and nobody else will, it totally misrepresents the situation. Part of the Paris Agreement is a commitment to a green climate fund, and this is really financing that will help the poorer nations transition during climate change and adapt and invest in resiliency, and that's good for all of us so that there won't be humanitarian and environmental crises that we have to intervene in. And the fund will also help them to mitigate and cut their emissions to address the problem. And it's really a about $10 billion fund, and the U.S. pledged $3 billion to it over 4 years. And we are not alone in this pledge. Over 40 countries pledged money to this fund, and major commitments from countries like Japan and Britain and France and Germany. So you just mischaracterize the situation in suggesting that the U.S. is overpaying. You know, we're one of the richest countries in the world. We benefited from industrialization. We've produced a rich country by producing an awful lot of greenhouse gases. And the poorer countries haven't yet had the benefit of development. And so it makes some sense to assist them in this transition. And I think the Obama administration's pledge of $3 billion was a very reasonable and modest down payment. And Obama actually managed to make good on about $1 billion of that pledge before leaving office.
So can it be undone? I mean, obviously there's been some buzz that the international leadership, like Merkel, I assume, and the British PM and others are trying to weigh in and discourage Trump from pulling the plug on the Paris Accords.
It's interesting because, you know, you can undermine the U.S.'s commitment to the Paris Accords just by doing the kinds of things the president has already announced that he wants to do, by unraveling the domestic policies that are key to fulfilling our pledge. So he's already announced that he wants the EPA to take another look and roll back potentially the Clean Power Plan, which is regulation of greenhouse gases from the electricity sector for the first time. He's already said he's interested and expects the EPA to take another look at the fuel efficiency standards that have doubled fuel efficiency standards out to the year 2025. If those policies are significantly weakened or unraveled, we won't be able to meet our short-term Paris pledge. So that's one way to undermine Paris. The other way is to actually do what it sounds like he says he's leaning toward doing, but we won't quite know until he tells us, and that is to officially begin the process of withdrawing from the Paris Agreement. And that's really just an unnecessary poke in the eye of all of the U.S. allies. And it's also going to set back a lot of U.S. business that thinks there are benefits to come from being part of the Paris Agreement and ongoing international negotiations. So to me, it's an unnecessary kind of gasp for attention. I think the international community, to be honest with you, Ian, has already internalized the very strong possibility that the U.S. is not going to deliver in the short term on its pledge. I think they've already figured out that this guy may well, just to get press attention and cater to a certain narrow constituency, may actually begin the withdrawal process. But the fact is that withdrawal process as a legal matter takes 4 years. And so it would only take effect into the next presidential administration. And, of course, depending on who the president is in 4 years, they may well reverse things and want to be a member again of the international community.
Well, do you think, for example, that his new best friend, Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, he might notice that they're switching as quickly as they can now, notwithstanding that they've done, I think, greater environmental damage and now people can't even breathe in Shanghai and Beijing. So there is obviously a growing constituency in China to deal with the awful damage that has already been done to their environment. I don't know whether you noticed the big story in today's New York Times about how the Chinese international fishing fleet is basically killing off fish stocks around the world. So there are major problems that aren't being dealt with, but it does seem that China is at least on the path of dealing with them. And if our leaders are trying to turn back from the path already that we've been on.
Look, there's no greater winner from Trump's antics than the Chinese. The idea that the U.S. would publicly say it's withdrawing from an international agreement it led just makes way for the Chinese to become the new leaders of international climate change. And the irony of this just should not be lost on the United States. Nobody will benefit more from developing their clean technology than China, from being a leader in solar power, from being a leader in battery research and storage. They're going to move right into the territory when we recede. And so this is just a fundamental and tragic mistake for American business and innovation and international leadership. There's no question the Chinese are dealing with this problem. I don't think they're primarily driven by climate change, though it is a concern because they will suffer from both drought and flooding and erratic weather events, there's no doubt. But I think they're primarily obviously driven by what you cited, Ian, which is local conventional air pollution problems that are killing hundreds of thousands of Chinese. And the growing middle class is realizing that they need to have and want to have a basic minimum standard of environmental health and protection, and that's what the Chinese are going to deliver. So they're on a path to slow their CO2 emissions and to reduce their other conventional pollution. They're going to invest heavily, as they already are, in renewable energy. And it's astonishing that with the Trump administration in power, we are laggards behind China in this domain. I think we just all shake our heads and think, what a lost opportunity for the United States.
Well, just in closing, though, Trump is doing real damage. The EPA budget, which he's cutting, eviscerating, almost putting them out of business. Their work on batteries, which apparently has been extremely helpful, mm-hmm. has all but been erased as a budget item.
Well, so, the budget is stark and quite shocking. 31% cut for EPA's budget and 21% cut for its workforce. It's the hardest hit agency of all of the federal agencies in the Trump budget proposal. You cannot miss the message. The message is we wish to dismantle the enforcement power of this agency. Now, presidents very rarely get what they want in their budgets, right? It has to go through the Congress. But the signaling is very clear, and that is that this whole investment in public health protection and environmental protection is not a priority of this agency, this administration, and nor is it particularly a priority of Scott Pruitt, who now runs the EPA. And so I think the budget is signaling something that President Trump has been signaling since he took office, and that is that they're just prepared to roll everything back to the extent they can. Just before closing, I want to say that may be the aspiration, but there are a lot of steps to take to execute such a dramatic and drastic set of cutbacks. And you can bet that there are an army of states and non-governmental organizations that are interested in the public health and environmental groups and citizens that are prepared to litigate every effort to go beyond what the law allows the Trump administration to do in rolling these things back. So you're about to see trench warfare in the courts to try to resist what people think is just a historic retrenchment. And I think we'll be seeing that unfold over the next few years.
Well, Jody Freeman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I'll be speaking with Jody Freeman, who's an Archibald Cox professor at Harvard Law School and the founding director of Harvard Law School's Environmental Law and Policy Program, the co-author of Global Climate Change and U.S. Law. She served as counselor for energy and climate change in the Obama White House. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the latest anemic quarterly GDP numbers of growth of 0.7%.
makes the world go around. The world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around. It makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound.
A mark, a yen,
a buck or a pound. Is all that makes the world go around. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Stephanie Kelton, who's a professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. She served as chief economist on the United States Senate Banking Committee, Budget Committee in 2015, and then became an economic advisor to Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign. She's the author of The State, the Market, and the Euro, and has an article at the Real World Economics Review, Can Trumponomics Extend the Recovery? Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephanie Kelton.
Thanks for having me.
And the quarterly GDP report is pretty anemic, growth of 0.7%. But of course, you wouldn't know that from the rally yesterday that Trump held in Pennsylvania, where he once again blamed Obama and talked about what this incredible mess that he inherited. I mean, talk about an alternative universe. Obama inherited probably the greatest economic mess since FDR inherited the Great Depression. I mean, that's just inescapably true, is it not?
Yeah, it definitely is true. At the time President Obama took the oath of office, the U.S. was entering the, as you say, the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. And we were losing on the order of 800,000 jobs every month in this country. So, yes, President Obama inherited a catastrophe. Donald Trump maybe inherited an economy that has been growing since the summer of 2009, but probably, you know, fair to say that it was not a robust economic recovery by any stretch of the imagination. The recovery has been, while economists call it a recovery, it's been fairly lackluster, and things may have been slowing down as Donald Trump came into office. So he didn't inherit anything like what President Obama inherited, but it may be fair to say that he inherited a slowing economy.
Well, there have been arguments, of course, that when Obama took over, he could have acted more boldly. He could have got a bigger stimulus package. But it's worth noting that the Republicans did not vote. None of them voted for the stimulus to recover, to allow the economy to recover and to invest in recovery. And they fought him every inch of the way. It's pretty extraordinary, don't you think, Stephanie Kelton, to look at what's happening now, where the obstructionists, the Republicans, who thwarted Obama at every turn to try and improve the economy, now have an opportunity to do something, and they can't agree on anything.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting to watch. You're right. The economic recovery was at least in part due to the fact that the Democrats passed a fairly large, but I think most economists, certainly those on the left, would argue it was not big enough, but the numbers looked fairly large to most people, $787 billion stimulus under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. That was done, as you said, without any Republican votes. And now that Republicans are in control of both houses and the White House, and they could theoretically run the table, they haven't been able to deliver any real legislative victories at all for this president.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephanie Kelton, who's professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. She served as chief economist on the United States Senate Budget Committee and then became an economic advisor to Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign, is the author of The State, the Market, and the Euro, and has an article at Real World Economics Review, Can Trumponomics Extend the Recovery? Let's talk about Trumponomics. I mean, for God's sake, Trumponomics comes down to a one page that was waved in front of the cameras a couple of days ago by the Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin and Gary Cohn from Goldman Sachs, the budget director. That, I think, by any standard, was a kind of an insult, wasn't it, to the intelligence of everybody, not to mention every economist on the planet?
It was pretty shocking. As an economist, that was a pretty remarkable thing to release, for sure. You know, that isn't the whole. It certainly isn't intended to be the whole of Trumponomics. Trumponomics, I guess, is supposed to be the entire legislative agenda, all of the economic programs, including what he wants to do on the tax side, but also what he wanted to do on the spending side. And so really it should have included, if you want to talk about Trumponomics and what it is that this president thinks that he can accomplish in terms of boosting economic growth and creating millions of jobs and so forth, you have to, I think, include the infrastructure piece. He told us that he was going to do $1 trillion of infrastructure investment. He talked about trade, bringing back jobs to America. And, you know, we had talk of this border adjustment tax. They were supposed to repeal and replace Obamacare. And so I would wrap my arms around all of the agenda and call that, you know, the Trumponomics. But you're right. I mean, on the tax piece, it was to say that it was a very broad brush paint job is to understate exactly what was released. It was a memo that you might circulate within the administration as just a starting point for discussion, not nearly the kind of thing that one would expect an administration to go public with as the cornerstone of the tax agenda going forward.
So let's talk about Trumponomics and why you think well, let's start with that. Can it extend the recovery or not? I mean, I suspect the answer is the latter.
Well, actually, in this piece that I wrote for Real World Economic Review, I took a different position than I think a lot of economists, certainly those on the left, the Paul Krugmans and the Larry Summers and so forth. Most of them have decided that Trumponomics is just this doomed to fail. It can't possibly deliver on any of its stated objectives, where those stated objectives are, you know, high levels of economic growth, essentially a doubling of the types of growth rates that the U.S. economy has achieved over the course of the last 7 years or so. And so if we're muddling through with about 2% GDP growth per year, Donald Trump says he wants to do much better than that, say 3.5%, 4% growth. And most of the economists on the left don't think he can pull it off. And what I argued in this recent piece is that I think that that's a mistake to assume that the kinds of things that he's talking about, everything from, you know, deregulation to these massive tax cuts, the infrastructure investment, I think that it can generate significantly higher growth in the near term. And even Goldman Sachs, who's taken a look at this in Moody's Analytics, can say, look, it's possible that these are the kinds of things that can boost short-term economic growth. But they're not going to produce the kind of robust, sustained economic growth for the economy going forward. What they can do is juice the economy as people take advantage of, you know, these repatriation, allowing corporations to bring profits that are being held offshore back at very low tax rates. And the expectation is, well, the way that Trump says it is that if you allow them to do this, they're going to invest and create all kinds of jobs in the real economy. Most people don't believe that. They understand that what these firms are likely to do is to bring these dollars back and then do what? Well, pay dividends or share buybacks. You know, they're going to boost equity prices. So the stock market's going to boom. Now, that's the kind of thing that when you get a bubbling up of the stock market or real estate markets or whatever, you can get rapidly increased economic activity. We saw that with the subprime mortgage crisis. We saw that in the Clinton years, in the late 90s and early 2000s. You know, you can have a burst of economic activity. And so what I'm saying is this is not a smart way to grow the economy, but it is possible that some of the things he's talking about doing, if he's successful in getting them done, could produce what I would call an artificial economic boom, which creates, you know, rapidly increased growth, more jobs, and on the surface, for a time, it's going to look like a better economy before things begin to unwind. And that's what happens when stock markets crash or when you deregulate industries like Wall Street, and then we allow them to go out and behave badly for a while. And that, you know, includes things like what happened in the subprime mortgage industry. And you can get lots of things happening that cause spending to increase and boost the economy, but then it doesn't end well.
Well, there are ticking time bombs out there, like subprime auto loans, for example. But
auto loans, student debt, yeah.
Student debt, right. So, but just in general, though, I get the impression that that Trump operates on government by stunt and by photo op. For example, his foreign policy of late has been to distract people from the Russian inquiry by throwing cruise missiles at Syria, dropping a big bomb in Afghanistan, and threatening war with North Korea. And in terms of the economy, if indeed there is this, what you've described still sounds like a bit of a stunt with the short-term growth because of these maneuvers that he's planning. But what about the extraordinary tax cuts, the idea of pass-through companies where the IRS simply won't be collecting revenues? And I don't see, when will that all kick in? In other words, when will the deficit explode if you to take that one page that Mnuchin and Cohen waved at the press the other day? Seriously.
Well, the deficit may well explode, but I don't think that that's the way that we ought to be critiquing the Trump agenda. The problem isn't that it's so-called budget busting. The problem is that it will bust the Gini coefficient, which is a measure that economists use and rely on to measure the degree of inequality, income and wealth inequality in a country. So I'm far less concerned about the budgetary effects of what Donald Trump is talking about doing. We could talk about an economic agenda, a very progressive economic agenda that may well increase budget deficits, but I would be perfectly happy with that if the result of the increase in the deficit was that we were doing more to invest in infrastructure and education and R&D, and that we were lifting people from the bottom, that we were pulling millions of children out of poverty, that we were addressing joblessness, that we were addressing climate and other sorts of things. So I'm far less concerned with what Trump's economic policies, the impact of those policies on the budget deficit. In a sense, I'd say, who cares?
Right.
It's far more important to say, how are they going to affect the real economy? Who wins from those increased budget deficits? Remember that Reagan blew up the debt and the deficit, nearly tripled the national debt, building up military spending, right? And these huge tax cuts and so forth. And we had rapid economic growth during the recovery phase of the business cycle under Reagan, and he was reelected in a landslide, right?
Right.
So, anyway, that's my position.
I know. Well, let's not end on the nightmare notion that Trump is going to get reelected. I thank you very much for joining us, Stephanie Kelton.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephanie Kelton, who's a professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. She served as chief economist on the United States Senate Banking Committee and became economic advisor to Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign. And she has an article at the Real World Economics Review, Can Trumponomics Extend the Recovery? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.